we have already studied so far, is he's talking about what changes are likely to exist between the operation of supramental consciousness in terms of human instrumentation. That is, we have a mind which seeks for knowledge, what is going to happen to knowledge and the way the mind seeks for it. Why is it the mind seeks for knowledge? How is it that it seeks for it? And what is the difference between that and the supermind seeking for knowledge? Similarly, he'll talk about how is it the life being, you know, again, talking about the complexity of the being. That's why it is necessary to posit these things, because the life being's gati, its swadharma, is different from that of the mind. It looks for something else. And supermind achieves the same goal in other ways. Similarly, the body and its own kind of, you know, sort of law is different. Its law of becoming is different. So the first part that he takes up is this aspect of knowledge, seeking for knowledge. And that's what we finished. I remember vaguely that I was trying to draw attention to the operation of creative intelligence, how creativity works in heightened moments when we actually feel as if whatever it is that we're trying to create exists in all its steps at the same time, and a certain choice is made in drawing it out into its various steps in time and space. This exactly is, I mean, in a kind of limited way, how the intuition works as well. Intuition is a flash of seeing in which what the mind represents as a number of logical steps are contained all at once. And in expressing it, there is a certain will that chooses the steps and marks them out in a certain sequence in time and space. So that kind of operation taken to its absolute height, where the single consciousness that inhabits all things has knowledge hidden, but at its access, just like a memory that is available to it. And as it seeks, it brings all the various knowledge that it has mobilized in certain steps in time and space. So that's how he says that instead of groping for knowledge or instead of releasing knowledge out of darkness, which is what the mind does, the supermind will release knowledge out of light because it already knows, but it is as if it has hidden it from itself in a background to which it can have ready access. And immediately kind of, you know, by intimate identity, draw that knowledge to the front. So that's where we were at present. And so Sri Aurobindo was saying that the joy of knowledge is still here. And we also discussed the fact that it is by dint of the infinity of Brahman and, of course, of supermind that joy inheres in every act of knowledge. Because were it not truly infinite, though the sense of identity pervades its being, that infinity causes it to wonder and attaches a certain paradoxical element to its experience. The paradox of the experience of infinity is that it knows and knows not at the same time. It is as if it's viewing an end which is unpredictable and unknown, and yet, of course, it is intimately known because it is itself. This is actually, in a way, very nicely brought out by that Upanishad, sort of those lines in the Isha Upanishad that I think Vince was talking about recently. You know, the one unmoving is swifter than thought. It moves and it moves not. It is very close to us and it is very far away. So that is the basis of the experience of infinity in the Brahman. It knows and it knows not. It moves and it moves not. It is and it is not. That is the kind of, you know, that is the cause of divine wonder and joy in the finding of knowledge which is already present.
Vince, would you like to start reading?
Sure. As mind, excuse me, as mind seeks for light, for the discovery of knowledge, and for mastery by knowledge, so life seeks for the development of its own force and for mastery by force. Its quest is for growth, power, conquest, possession, satisfaction, creation, joy, love, beauty. Its joy of existence is in a constant self-expression, development, diverse manifoldness of action, creation, enjoyment, an abundant and strong intensity of itself and its power. The Gnostic evolution will lift that to its highest and fullest expression, but it will not act for the power, satisfaction, enjoyment of the mental or vital ego. For its narrow possession of itself and its eager, ambitious grasp on others and on things, or for its greater self-affirmation and magnified embodiment. For in that way, no spiritual fullness and perfection can come. The Gnostic life will exist and act for the divine in itself and in the world, for the divine in all. The increasing possession of the individual being in the world by the divine presence, light, power, love, delight, beauty, will be the sense of life to the Gnostic being. In the more and more perfect satisfaction of that growing manifestation will be the individual's satisfaction. His power will be the instrumentation of the power of supernature for bringing in and extending that greater life in nature. Whatever conquest and adventure will be there, will be for that only and not for the reign of any individual or collective ego. Love will be for him the contact, meaning, union of self with self, of spirit with spirit, a unification of being, of power and joy and intimacy and closeness of soul to soul, of the one to the one, a joy of identity and the consequences of a diverse identity. It is this joy of an intimate, self-revealing diversity of the one, the multitudinous union of the one in a happy interaction in the identity, that will be for him the full revealed sense of life. Creation, aesthetic or dynamic, mental creation, life creation, material creation, will have for him the same sense. It will be the creation of significant forms of eternal force, light, beauty, reality. The beauty and truth of its forms and bodies, the beauty and truth of its powers and qualities, the beauty and truth of its spirit, its formless beauty of self and essence.
So as with the seeking for knowledge, which belongs to the mind, he takes up life being. And he talks about the various qualities that form the drive of the life being. And he's talking about its quest for growth, power, conquest, possession, satisfaction, creation, joy, love, and beauty. And then here he's talking about from all these particular variety of quests. He's talking about, you know, action, creation, and enjoyment. You know, so these various forms of aspiration or drive of the vital are perfectly legitimate because they belong to a certain aspect of the spirit. But supermind therefore also has this part to it. This is the power aspect of supermind, just as what was previous to it was the knowledge aspect of supermind. Consciousness as power proceeds towards an extension of these kinds of delight. Now, he makes the distinction again between normal experience of vital delight, which is based in the ego, and supramental experience of the delight of power of consciousness, which is based in the divine. In the first, we find that sense of separation of the human being or individual. Sense of separation of the individual, which forms the experience of ego, is what the life force experiences itself through. And that brings a certain kind of trouble to all its experiences. The trouble has partly to do with the sense of loss and fear of loss, and partly to do with the sense of fear of insecurity of the other, because there is separateness, there is always the fear that something which is not oneself will extinct oneself. And hence, this drive towards the experience of growth, conquest, etc., of life, this power of action, is something that measures itself in terms of competition, of possession, of eradication, of assimilation of others to oneself. So that aspect has to completely disappear. In its place, there will be the experience of the growth of power, the power of the One. So it is as if the perception of the One in all things will give the being a certain sense of security and a power of flowering of the spirit. So that's where he talks about the transformed sense of the Gnostic life. And he says Gnostic life will exist and act for the divine in itself and the world, for the divine in all. So where the action part is concerned, he's describing it in terms of more and more perfect satisfaction of that growing manifestation will be the individual satisfaction. So this manifestation of the divine power is what the individual will perceive and give his energy to. This giving of the energy, of the instrument and the energy of the Shakti of the individual is a source of tremendous joy, because it will be seen that in all things it is the divine that comes to birth through that instrument and through that energy. His power will be the instrumentation of the power of supernature for bringing in and extending that greater life in nature. So this part in a way connects with the whole idea of Karma Yoga and with the Gita's doctrine of divine works, where there is a surrender of the fruits of action and a disappearance of the sense of the doer. Instead, the knowledge of the joy of the instrument being utilized by the divine for his own purposes. So that kind of basis will allow the transformed delight of life to flow through the individual. Whatever conquest and adventure will be there, will be for that only and not for the reign of any individual or collective ego. So again, the same thing. I mean, growth, conquest, all this is really a kind of an expression of the expanding life force of divine in its manifestation. And that's what will give whatever joy there is to the being. And then he takes the other two major aspects, the aspect of love and the aspect of creativity. He talks about love again as an experience in which, in all things, the vital energy in us will receive the impress of the One. This is also similar to what we studied last time, where we saw how the senses and all other forms of reception of the environment are being translated to the knowledge of the Divine One, who is coming to us in all the various experiences of the world. So here too, as far as the life energy is concerned, this is what when we were studying, for example, Shakti Chatushtaya, the whole idea of Samarthya, you see, Bhoga Samarthya is the the kind of siddhi of the Shakti that he talks of there. So capacity to enjoy, and that is the enjoyment, the divine, the purified, Shuddha Bhukti, purified enjoyment that will receive the divine intensity in all its experiences, knowing that it is the One Being who is coming to us in everything. That attitude will have no attachment to it, no sense of possession to it, but will experience the One in all beings in every contact that comes to it, and will recognize that it is the One who is coming to us. That change of perception is the basis of the transformation, which will be set with the mental thought, creativity and creation. And here he's saying mental, aesthetic, dynamic, mental creation, life creation, material, all these forms of creation will have the same sense. What will be the creation? It will be various forms that will be significant forms of the eternal force, light, beauty, reality. Beauty and truth of its forms and bodies, the beauty and truth of its powers and qualities, beauty and truth of its spirit, its formless beauty of self and essence. So in all these forces, the creative capabilities, it is the divine who will express its own forms, significant forms, in a variety of ways. So this is the way in which the life force will be utilized to a transformed use in the Gnostic being.
So the wisdom. Even for the initial, the initial realizations before the Gnostic being and the supermind, already the being is in this mode, right, where he or she is not working for the enjoyment of the ego, either his own or the collective. It's already to some degree impersonalized, isn't it?
Yeah, no doubt. Absolutely. In fact, all these things that he's talking about are conditions of yoga, which have to already be in under practice, and already one may say have reached their siddhi in a normal human being. So the spiritual consciousness working through the human instrument already must have achieved a very high level of the perfection of all these various aspects of life expression. Now, once that is possible, then only the supermind can actually settle and utilize the being in a natural way in all these forms. You see, the whole thing about, what we were discussing last time is that, Purusha and Prakriti, Purusha in and by itself cannot achieve that much. Purusha can be free, but Purusha can't bring new qualities into existence. Delight of existence is something which belongs to Prakriti. And so what we have to look for are new centers of order. The first center of integral ordering that we find is the psychic being. So all these things that he's talking about develop a natural movement. It is no longer a practice. It is not that we actually follow the Gita's injunction and develop a certain type of action in which we perceive more and more that this is what is happening. But it is as if a new center of order is developed in us in which this is the natural, mode of behavior. So that natural center of order is what is achieved in three stages through the triple transformation. And at the supramental stage, it receives its final, sanction and working ability, because here it is the one being in all things who is felt concretely as having taken up all these various instrumentations of the being.
So there was just that. What you just said about, it being a natural order of things and not something that, you read the Gita and then you do this. So this brings the question that, at what point, in a way, when we read and simulate and practice, we are really putting the cart before the horse, right? Like, we're kind of trying to fake the end result. And not really, and this is a question I probably have asked you before, and it's something that comes
No, I don't think we're trying to fake the result, Shyam. It is putting the horse before the cart, because unless one practices it, one will never be able to give the purified instrument to the supramental being. You see, it is only when one has achieved those sort of siddhis that these experiences can become naturalized in us. That's the whole thing about the preparation. That, in fact, and I've reflected a lot on this, this is really part of the reason why we are so, so far away from the supramental manifestation even today. Because humanity without preparation cannot be taken up by the supermind. Supramental consciousness awaits human preparation. Only when the preparation has reached a certain point, these things can start acting in us. And then they will be experienced as natural. But without the unnatural practice of preparing ourselves and experiencing the spirit acting in this fashion, supermind will not be able to take up the human consciousness. Now, one may say that supermind itself can do the preparation. And this is indeed what Sri Aurobindo and the mother believed, which is why he kept saying, when the supermind comes, it will decide for itself, etc. And of course, maybe that preparation is going on. But without that preparation, supermind cannot reach these particular kinds of experiences into us.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Devashish.
I was wondering, when you said that the light of existence is part of Prakriti,
the light of existence?
No.
Delight of existence.
Delight.
Delight of existence. Yeah. You see, the thing is this, that Purusha in and by itself is a passive presence. See, Purusha's, best aspect, Purusha has will. But Purusha in and by itself, particularly in the ignorance, Purusha is only known as presence. Now, whatever quality is there belongs to Prakriti. Prakriti is the origin of all qualities, guna. Here, as he says, it restricts itself to three gunas. But in its origin, it is ananta guna, of infinite quality. Those qualities are Prakriti's qualities. The primary quality of all those qualities is delight, bliss. Therefore, the experience of bliss belongs to Prakriti. With Purusha, one may experience the neutrality of calm. But if there is to be the experience of bliss, whether in the mind, body, or vital, these are all by the streaming of Prakriti. So what kind of Prakriti is acting in us? That becomes the real question. Are we going to put Prakriti to sleep? If we put it to sleep, then all we'll experience is maybe the delight of Nirvana. But if there is, on the other hand, a new center of order in which a higher Prakriti starts acting in us, then the quality of the experience changes, the quality of the delight changes, and we start experiencing the divine delight.
So that would be like our Prakriti?
Yeah, exactly. That would be the what we were studying, for example, this weekend. It is in fact the experience of the delight of the Divine Mother, the bliss of the Divine Mother, or the Shakti acting to us.
Well, how does that differ from experiencing delight of existence, the kind of delight that's beyond the dualities?
Yeah, delight of being, that is beyond the dualities, as you say, delight of existence, the delight which is without any necessary expression, which needs no cause, can be there without Prakriti. That is the delight of Purusha, in fact. Delight of existence, pure and simple, is the delight of Purusha. But delight of existence doesn't even need us to be embodied beings. We don't even need a life being or a mind being for the delight of existence. All we need is a spiritual sort of being, you know. We could just be, Purusha and experience the delight of existence. But delight of manifestation in any way or form, delight of any kind of expression, whether mental, vital, physical, supramental, or of any plane, is really a translation of the delight of existence through the power of Shakti or Prakriti.
So if we feel the kind of delight that just is, it doesn't depend on anything.
Yeah.
It's still part of Prakriti.
No. That is the delight of Purusha. The one that just is and doesn't depend on anything is the delight of Purusha.
Okay.
Purusha has delight, but and that delight is self-sufficient. It's self-contained and self-sufficient. But that is not the same as the delight of manifestation. It's necessary for the delight of manifestation. I mean, what you just talked about is the first necessity of any spiritual experience. I mean, our transformation and the supramental transformation also rests on it. All that we are talking about is resting on that delight which needs nothing, the delight of existence, which is the Purusha delight. But on the other hand, it is not sufficient. As you know, anything to be properly described needs necessary and sufficient conditions.
Okay.
It is so necessary, but it is not sufficient.
So that's just a starting point for the transformation. So
it's a starting point, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Louise, did you want to read? Are you there, Louise?
Sorry, I was muted. I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry. As a consequence.
Yeah.
As a consequence of total change and reversal of consciousness, establishing a new relation of spirit and mind and life and matter, and a new significance and perfection in the relation, there will be a reversal, a perfecting new significance also of the relations between the spirit and the body it inhabits. In our present way of living, the soul expresses itself as best it can or as badly as it must through the mind and the vitality, or more often allows the mind and the vitality to act with its support. The body is the instrument of this action, But the body, even in obeying, limits and determines the mind's and the life's self-expression by the limited possibilities and acquired character of its own physical instrumentation. It has, besides a law of its own action, a movement and will or force or urge of movement of its own subconscious or half-emerged conscious power of being, which they can only partially, and even in that part more by an indirect than by a direct, or if direct, then more by a subconscious than a willed and conscious action, influence or alter. But in the Gnostic way of being and living, the will of the spirit must directly control and determine the movements and law of the body. For the law of the body arises from the subconscient or inconscient. In the Gnostic being, the subconscient will have become conscious and subject to the supramental control and penetrated with its light and action. The basis of inconscience, with its obscurity and ambiguity, its obstruction or tardy responses, will have been transformed into a lower or supporting superconscience by the supramental emergence. Already, even in the realized higher mind being and in the intuitive and overmind being, the body will have become sufficiently conscious to respond to the influence of the idea and the will force, so that the action of mind on the physical parts, which is rudimentary, chaotic, and mostly involuntary in us, will have developed a considerable potency. But in the supramental being, it is the consciousness with the real idea in it which will govern everything. This real idea is a truth perception which is self-effective, for it is the idea and will of the spirit in direct action and originates of movement of the substance of being, which must inevitably effectuate itself in state and act of being. It is this dynamic, irresistible spiritual realism of the truth consciousness in the higher degree of itself that will have here grown conscient and consciously competent in the evolved Gnostic being. It will not act as now, veiled in an apparent inconscience and self-limited by law of mechanism, but as the sovereign reality in effectuating action, in self-effectuating action. It is this that will rule the existence with an entire knowledge and power, and include its rule the functioning and action of the body. The body will be turned by the power of the spiritual consciousness into a true and fit and perfectly responsive instrument of the spirit.
So after considering the mind and the life being, now Sri Aurobindo takes up the physical being or the body. And as he points out, the body is usually something which has its basis in the inconscient. Therefore, you know, it kind of translates the values of our higher parts into highly distorted and sort of involuntary movements. So he points out that, you know, as it is, even something deeper like the soul has to act through a variety of intermediate instruments like the mind and the vital. And they again in part have to act through the body. So there is all these various refractions, one may say, distortions of transmission that take place. And then finally, the body has its own deeply limited nature, which arises out of its roots in the inconscious. Body is the way by which matter, which houses inconscious, becomes conscious. Body is really the link between inconscious and consciousness. So human body is already something which is quite marvelous in the sense of being living matter. It has properties that inconscient matter has sort of developed that are quite miraculous when one thinks about inorganic dead matter. So this kind of a medium for the expression of spirit is yet in a very highly kind of compromised condition and very rudimentary in its ability to give a higher pitch to the value of the spirit in its expression. Here he's talking about something that relates to the question Shyam asked about, you know, with regard to life, that what is the difference between this kind of operation of the body under the Gnostic consciousness and a body, for example, like in the other case, a life force that has been trained by the yoga of the Gita. Now here he actually draws attention to something that we have studied in the Life Divine itself when he was talking about the various levels of cosmic mind. Remember, he spoke of how the higher we go in cosmic mind, the greater amount of power on matter it has. Yet it is not an absolute control over matter. Ultimately, there is a slippage, and the independent law of matter asserts itself and pulls everything down to the dust of death. You know, the living is kind of subject to the non-living. But at the same time, we find, you know, I mean, even without going to things like illumined mind and intuitive mind, we find even in ordinary human beings, those who are really inspired by an idea often show tremendous, you know, sort of abilities of the body to organize itself around that idea. Inspired people live their whole life for the idea. The whole body organizes its routine, its action, and its endurance. And even one may say, to some extent, it can push the limits of its own life, its ability to house life, based on the success of the idea to which it has attached itself. These are operations of living matter that are more, you know, extraordinary than the normal law, statistical law to which the body is subject as an operation of inconscience. But if there is action of the higher cosmic mind planes that takes place, the higher we go, the more directly it seems to have an effect on body as well. And this is where we were talking about how particularly when we come to the intuition plane, that the intuition plane is not merely a mental plane in that sense, but it starts directly acting on mind, life, and matter, opening up a mental intuition, a vital intuition, and a physical intuition in one's everyday life. So that's where we start finding that this transformation is beginning, that there is a certain response of physical substance to higher consciousness. But as I said, it cannot complete itself. It only achieves a certain degree of transformation, even up to the overmind. If the overmind were to fully come into mind, life, and body, as it did, say, in the case of Sri Aurobindo in 1936, it starts manifesting a certain degree of divinity in the physical, but still it is not a complete manifestation, and there is a slippage towards death. And it's here where, you know, what we see the difference between all these yogic formulations and the complete action of the Gnostic consciousness. It totally transforms the law of modality of that consciousness. This is what happens in the case of the life being. This is what happens in the case of matter. Matter becomes completely transformed and takes up a different kind of law of existence, which is really the supramental matter. And so that is, you know, what expresses itself without, completely without the inconscience to which all other forms of control are subject.
So there was just at this point, what is the you know, the texture of the subconscious and those and the chitta and those areas at this time? Have they gotten also, you know, some degree of transformation, so to say, or are they no longer, subconscient? They are all conscient themselves.
Yeah, that's a tricky question, because I think all this is progressive. See, this thing about the material transformation of the matter in the living individual, like in the body, in the human body, reaches its final culmination. That is, if there is the possibility of immortality, then we have to say that the subconscious has been sufficiently transformed for that to happen. Now, does that mean the universal subconscious has been completely transformed? My answer would be probably not. Again, there are provinces, there are degrees to which these things may happen, and it will take time for larger transformations to occur, more and more universal domains to get transformed. If we talk about, for example, the subconscious, we can talk about an individual subconscious, and then we can talk about various formulations of cosmic subconscious, like, for example, the subconscious of a certain community, or of a certain nation, or even of a certain species. So, like the human subconscious, for example. And, it's only in terms of a complete eradication or transformation of subconscious that you can talk of something that kind of has infiltrated into the very basis of non-matter and, kind of achieved a Gnostic consciousness established here. But I think that is a very far cry. Long before that is, various degrees of the transformation of subconscious. In an individual, Sri Aurobindo actually in his letters even talks about the progress of the supramental taking place first in individual forms. And in those cases, you may say that it's the individual subconscious that has been sufficiently transformed for a different kind of working of the physical to take place. But then he says, he's talking of the Gnostic community. So a number of individuals form their own reality, and that entire thing can be changed. Then, an entire nation may probably be subject to something like this transformation. So there are degrees through which this transforming power proceeds. Even as far as the physical is concerned, it's hardly overnight that the physical will express completely a supramental, power in its own shakti. What it will do is probably first achieve some of the earlier stages, like, the ability to experience everything as delight, the Ichha Mrityu, the ability to consciously sort of divide or separate itself from the body. These kinds of are the ability to very gradually absorb the consciousness before leaving the body. These kinds of experiences are more likely in the beginning. By beginning, I mean a very advanced age before subconscious can be completely transformed and body can express a fullness of Gnostic consciousness.
Yeah, thank you, Devashista. Thank you, Devashista. Alexandra, would you like to read next?
This new relation of the spirit and the body assumes and makes possible a free acceptance of the whole of material nature in place of a rejection, the drawing back from her, the refusal of all identification or acceptance, which is the first normal necessity of spiritual consciousness for its liberation, is no longer imperative. To cease to be identified with the body, to separate oneself from the body consciousness, is a recognized a necessary step whether towards spiritual liberation or towards spiritual perfection and mastery over nature. But this redemption once effected, the descent of the spiritual light and force can invade and take up the body also, and there can be a liberated and sovereign acceptance of material nature. That is possible indeed only if there is a changed communion of the spirit with matter, a control, a reversal of the present balance of interaction which allows physical nature to veil the spirit and affirm her own dominance. In the light of a larger knowledge, matter also can be seen to be the Brahman, a self-energy put forth by the Brahman, a form and substance of Brahman, aware of the secret consciousness within material substance. Secure in this larger knowledge, the Gnostic light and power can unite itself with matter, so seen, and accept it as an instrument of a spiritual manifestation. A certain reverence, even for matter, and a sacramental attitude in all dealings with it is possible. As in the Gita, the act of the taking of food is spoken of as a material sacrament, a sacrifice, an offering of Brahman to Brahman by Brahman. So also the Gnostic consciousness and sense can view all the operations of spirit with matter. The spirit has made itself matter in order to place itself there as an instrument for the well-being and joy, yoga sima, of created beings, for a self-offering of universal physical utility and service. The Gnostic being, using matter but using it without material or vital attachment or desire, will feel that he is using the spirit in this form of itself with its consent and sanction for its own purpose. There will be in him a certain respect for physical things, an awareness of the occult consciousness in them, of its dumb will of utility and service, a worship of the divine, the Brahman in what he uses, a care for perfect and faultless use of his divine material, for a true rhythm, ordered harmony, beauty in the life of matter, and the utilization of matter.
So here he points out this is actually the descent aspect of the entire, double movement, in which the entirety of nature is being accepted back into the divine with the full knowledge that all is Brahman. See, in a certain way, this entire passage is reminiscent of Bhrigu's tapasya, coming full circle. In Bhrigu's tapasya, he was asking the question to himself, what is Brahman? And he first establishes to himself that it is matter that is Brahman. But this knowledge of matter as Brahman is an incomplete knowledge, because though one may experience Brahman in the very, depth of matter, that matter, Brahman, is brooding in matter, as Sri Aurobindo puts it at one place, yet that self-locked quality of the Brahman makes it impossible for that particular power to be mobilized. Therefore, he is asked to go through and meditate again, to discover a more conscious power of Brahman in its expression. He arrives at life as Brahman. But there too, there is a certain degree of manifestation of consciousness. But the form of consciousness availing there is still not available in its truth. This is in another way one can say, in each of these, Bhrigu experiences Brahman to be the secret power, which is a form of consciousness, but it is expressing itself through a certain kind of prakriti, while Purusha is asleep in it in varying degrees. So that process continues from matter through life, through mind, through supermind, to pure delight. Delight of existence. At that point, he is told that you have now experienced the Brahman. That indeed is Brahman. In other words, the plane where Brahman is self-conscious. It is not any longer asleep within a partial activity of Prakriti. Prakriti is manifesting Brahman in its full potency. And Brahman is completely awake and in possession of its prakriti. That condition then becomes the basis for a return upon the various levels of semi-conscious and unconscious operations of Prakriti and Purusha. So that return necessarily starts acting upon these particular planes and releasing the power of Brahman in them in a divine expression. So this is exactly what is happening over here, in that in the particular return from the, in the particular movement upwards, there is necessary a certain division between that which is felt to be incomplete or unexpressed or unconscious and that which is striving for the form of perfect consciousness. So that separation that he's talking about, that is necessary and effective as a first step in any yoga, reaches a certain point and a certain realization, after which there is a descent and a taking up of that which has been neglected or rejected. So in that return, we come back ultimately to the lowest rung, which is that of matter. Now matter shows itself once more as Brahman. And this is exactly going back to Bhrigu's tapasya. Once he realizes that it is indeed ananda or delight that is Brahman, his father says to him, very good, this indeed is Brahman, but now go back down the steps that you had taken and at each step realize once more with this new knowledge that you have that mind is Brahman, life is Brahman and matter is Brahman. In other words, he is now bringing the full consciousness of awakened Brahman into these more semi-conscious states. And as he brings them there, that particular locked up knowledge becomes available for a new kind of expression. This is exactly what he's talking about in these particular paragraphs. And here, this specific paragraph deals exactly with that, in that there is a return on body, and this return actually causes a different relationship between spirit and matter. Now, in that relationship, he then talks about what is the nature, what is the quality. Again, we talk about Prakriti having quality. What is the quality of that new relationship? And that quality is, he says, a certain sacramental character. It is a certain sacredness. It is the concrete sense that God dwells in every material thing. Now, this is exactly why, you know, in the Sri Aurobindo ashram, the mother is working, and Sri Aurobindo's teaching too, so much emphasis was given to developing a consciousness of all material things as having a concealed life in them. That in fact, if we really want to come back upon this level, we need to start from the very scratch in developing or establishing the sacramental quality to our dealings with material things. And so here, just like he's drawing attention to the verses from the Gita, in which it says Brahman is the food offering. You know, Brahman is the eater, Brahman is the food offering. Brahman is the one who offers the food to Brahman. You know, and from and the objective is also for offering the food is Brahman. Creating that kind of perception allows the very act of eating to be something which is like a sacrament. So similarly, that kind of meditation on the idea of the exchanges of Brahman in matter is something that prepares the ground for that sacramental quality, establishing it so that again, just like in the other cases, as with life, etc., the yoga of the body prepares the taking up of this particular reality by the Gnostic consciousness.
Shall I read next?
It's important just to note in passing how each of these passages that we're reading, these paragraphs, first, you know, paragraphs concerning mind, then paragraphs concerning the life force, now paragraph concerning matter and the body, are talking about the fulfillment of these particular energies and their, you know, essence, their being, in terms of supramental shakti. But how at the same time, Sri Aurobindo is drawing attention to various forms of yoga in our normal condition that can prepare the ground. I think this is very important, because if that ground is not prepared, then this action of supramental energy, Gnostic consciousness, cannot achieve itself, even if it is here, descended, one may say. You know, this is a very important point. Also, one might see that certain traditional yogas have been developed, and he's drawing attention to them. Like with the mind, the whole yoga of jnana, of knowledge, has been developed. And so one may talk about preparation of the mind through bringing of silence, rising to a cosmic kind of level of seeing, perception, of being able to distinguish truth from falsehood, bringing in discrimination and intuition. All these various things are preparatory to the Gnostic consciousness being able to take up the mind. So too, with the life force, it is the yoga of Gita, karma yoga of the Gita, which is the preparation, which, if it has been achieved to a high degree, can prepare us for the taking up of the Gnostic consciousness. But here he is actually making a very important point, which is not so easily made traditionally, which one might call the yoga of matter. And the yoga of matter is essentially to keep a part of one's consciousness in this knowledge that all material manifestations, all material things, are actually forms of Brahman and Shakti that are expressing Brahman in a specific way. And if that sacramental quality can be brought in, if we deal with these things with the knowledge that there is a certain hidden, concealed consciousness of the divine in all these objects, then that is the yoga of matter that would prepare us for the possibility of a Gnostic, you know, realization at that level.
This new relation of the spirit and the body assumes and makes possible a free acceptance of the whole of material nature in place of a rejection, the drawing back from her, the refusal of all identification or acceptance, which is the first normal necessity of the spiritual consciousness for its liberation, is no longer imperative.
And this is the one we just finished, Shyam.
Can you just read this?
We just read this one. This is the one that Alexandra just read.
Yeah, sure.
You go to the next one.
Yeah.
As a result of this new relation.
As a result of this new relation between the spirit and the body, the Gnostic evolution will effectuate the spiritualization, perfection, and fulfillment of the physical being. It will do for the body as for the mind and life. Apart from the obscurity, frailties, and limitations, which this change will overcome, the body consciousness is a patient servant and can be, in its large reserve of possibilities, a potent instrument of the individual life, and it asks for little on its own account. What it craves for is duration, health, strength, physical perfection, bodily happiness, liberation from suffering, ease. These demands are not in themselves unacceptable, mean or illegitimate, for they render into the terms of matter the perfection of form and substance, the power and delight which should be the natural outflowing, the expressive manifestation of the spirit. When the Gnostic force can act in the body, these things can be established, for their opposites come from a pressure of external forces on the physical mind, on the nervous and material life, on the body organism, from an ignorance that does not know how to meet these forces or is not able to meet them rightly or with power, and from some obscurity pervading the stuff of the physical consciousness and distorting its responses, that reacts to them in a wrong way. A supramental self-acting, self-effectuating awareness and knowledge, replacing this ignorance, will liberate and restore the obscured and spoiled intuitive instincts in the body and enlighten and supplement them with a greater consciousness action, with a greater conscious action. This change would institute and maintain a right physical perception of things, a right relation and right reaction to objects and energies, a right rhythm of mind, nerve and organism. It would bring into the body a higher spiritual power and a greater life force, unified with the universal life force and able to draw on it, a luminous harmony with material nature and the vast and calm touch of the eternal repose which can give to it its diviner strength and ease. Above all, for this is the most needed and fundamental change, it will flood the whole being with a supreme energy of consciousness force, which would meet, assimilate, or harmonize with itself all the forces of existence that surround and press upon the body.
With this, he is actually continuing the concentration on the body, and he is elaborating on specifically, right, previously it was more on the relationship between spirit and matter, the body being one particular aspect of it, but he is also talking about spirit in all forms of matter. But now he is moving into this idea of specifically the human body. And he's talking about how the body is an instrument in itself, and in that form, it also needs to be perfected. And he says that just as he's pointed out, seeking of mind for knowledge, of life for all its various kinds of growth, and creativity, and delight, so too the body has its own kinds of aspirations and needs. It's interesting that, you know, in our weekend retreat, we talked about a lot of these things in the Shakti Chatushtha, particularly in the Shakti sort of section of it, where he talks about four kinds of Shakti, the first being the Deha Shakti, or Shakti of the body. This particular paragraph also relates to the Shakti Chatushtha, to the Sharira Chatushtha, the quartet of the body, where he points out the body's siddhis have to do with lack of disease, arogya, health, good health. And he brings out over here this kind of aspect. It creates duration, health, strength, physical perfection, bodily happiness, liberation from suffering and ease. So arogya, or freedom from disease, is the first real aspiration of the body. Then it has other aspirations. In that particular Sharira Chatushtha, the other aspirations he gives to the body are Arogya Uthapana, which means levitation literally, but actually it means two things. One is lightness of the body, and the second is consciousness to resist the forces of nature. Just as gravity is one of the most unconscious forces that holds us in our, rootedness to the earth, Uthapana refers to development of a force in the body which can actually escape from the unconscious forces of matter. The third one in that particular series is Saundarya, or beauty. By beauty, he also is referring to a certain harmony of the body. Here he puts down physical perfection as one of those needs of the urges of the body. So physical perfection is a certain kind of, you know, looking towards harmonizing all the various features of the body so that there is a certain kind of perfection that arises. And then the fourth one is delight, or over here Vivekananda, Ananda, the delight of the body. The body is an instrument that has its own sense of happiness all the time. So here he's talking about bodily happiness and liberation from suffering and ease. So the sense of the body's well-being, its sense of delight, of Ananda, these are the various urges or needs of the body. And he's basically saying that they are to be developed, and Gnostic force will release them in the body. Now, he goes through why it is that we don't experience this. We don't experience this because there's limitation in the body and there's inconscience in the body. External forces, when they exert their pressure on us, on the physical mind or nervous and material life, on the body organisms, the body doesn't know how to meet these forces, or not able to meet them rightly or in power. And essentially that kind of causes ill health, disease, ultimately death. Also, it causes distortion in the forces of the body, which brings a certain disharmony, physical disharmony, and dis-ease, you know, which is the opposite of ease, and inability to experience delight in the body, tiredness and lack of delight. So, of course, the same way as with all the others, he is pointing out that these, if we make them into goals or objectives, then our aspiration itself can begin establishing certain goals for the body. That is partly the yoga of the body. The yoga of the body is to achieve these, you know, siddhis. The siddhi of freedom from disease, of lightness, adaptability, and a certain kind of ability to defy the forces of unconscience. And also certain kind of harmony of the energies of the body, and ultimately the full play of the power of delight in the body. So here he's pointing out how the supramental energy, again, it requires us to develop the aspiration and to achieve these to some extent in ourselves. And if and when that happens, he points out how all these particular things would be established through the supramental energy. This change would institute and maintain a right physical perception of things, right relation and right reaction to objects and energies, a right rhythm of mind, life, and organism. This is like that aspect of harmony, that perception and maintenance of the harmony of all the physical energies is in itself something that brings a tremendous degree of freedom from disease and well-being. Then he's talking about the greater life force and higher spiritual power unified with the universal life force and able to draw on it. And that's also part of the whole idea of being free from forces of unconscience. Because just like Kuthapana, you can defy the force of gravity. You can also defy the need of the body to maintain itself all the time through taking energy from other material things. If there is direct influx of spiritual and life energy giving us energy. And then he's talking about this wonderful thing, ability to replenish itself. We talked about this also on the weekend in retreat. The ability by which there is a certain vast and calm touch of the eternal repose, which can give to a diviner strength and ease. This ability to rest in the spirit at any time, to draw back and feel the spirit giving rest from its eternity, its static eternity, to the body. And finally, he's talking about the influx of these spiritual energies, flood the whole being with the supreme energy of consciousness force, which will meet, assimilate, or harmonize with itself all the forces of existence that surround and press upon the body. That would give the expressive power to the body, but also it would be the source of all the various forms of delight that he's talking about in the Sharira Chatushtha. It would give the body this sort of resonance of a spiritual delight. So all these would be the fulfillments or siddhis of the body under the supramental action.
laid out in so much detail, no?
Yeah, indeed. It's amazing, actually. I mean, when you look at Sri Aurobindo's research, some of his sentences, his paragraphs are small, but so much is packed in it. And then when you look at it in comparison with other things he has written, and particularly now more and more as I look at the record of yoga, I see how specific and deeply, finely tuned is everything that he has written. Again, it's the same thing, you know, it's a matter of perception that, you know, if one doesn't know that, one kind of reads these paragraphs, one may even think that there's a kind of a romanticism, you know, he's a romantic, a poet of this kind of utterance. And what he's writing has a certain kind of a beauty to it, and he's talking in generalities about certain things. But it's only when one kind of delves into his entire corpus, one gets the sense of how non-general it is, how very specific it is. Everything that he says is very, very specific.
Vince, do you want to read next?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, we can hear you.
Okay. And as a result, I lost a paragraph, sorry.
It is the incompleteness. The next one, not as a result, the next one.
It is the incompleteness and weakness of the conscious force manifested in the mental, vital, and physical being, its inability to receive or refuse at will, or receiving, to assimilate or harmonize the contacts of the universal energy cast upon it, that is the cause of pain and suffering. In the material realm, nature starts with an entire insensibility, and it is a notable fact that either a comparative insensibility or a deficient sensibility, or, more often, a greater endurance and hardness to suffering is found in the beginnings of life, in the animal, in primitive or less developed man. As the human being grows in evolution, he grows in sensibility and suffers more keenly in mind, in life, in body. For the growth in consciousness is not sufficiently supported by a growth in force. The body becomes more subtle, more finely capable, but less solidly efficient in its external energy. Man has to call in his will, his mental power, to dynamize, correct and control his nervous being, force it to the strenuous tasks he demands from his instruments, steel it against suffering and disaster. In the spiritual ascent, this power of the consciousness and its will over the instruments, the control of spirit and inner mind over the outer mentality and the nervous being in the body, increases immensely. A tranquil and wide equality of the spirit to all shocks and contacts comes in and becomes the habitual poise. And this can pass from the mind to the vital parts and establish there too an immense and enduring largeness of strength and peace. Even in the body, this state may form itself and meet inwardly the shocks of grief and pain and all kinds of suffering. Even a power of willed physical insensibility can intervene, or a power of mental separation from all shock and injury can be acquired, which shows that the ordinary reactions and the debile submission of the bodily self to the normal habits of response of material nature are not obligatory or unalterable. Still more significant is the power that comes on the level of spiritual mind or overmind to change the vibrations of pain into vibrations of ananda. Even if this were only to go up to a certain point, it indicates the possibility of an entire reversal of the ordinary rule of the reacting consciousness. It can be associated, too, with a power of self-protection that turns away the shocks that are more difficult to transmute or to endure. The Gnostic evolution at a certain stage must bring about a completeness of this reversal and of this power of self-protection, which will fulfill the claim of the body for immunity and serenity of its being, and for deliverance from suffering, and build in it a power for the total delight of existence. A spiritual ananda can flow into the body and inundate cell and tissue. A luminous materialization of this higher ananda could of itself bring about a total transformation of the deficient or adverse sensibilities of physical nature.
So this is a really interesting paragraph in which he's talking about some of the problems of evolution of consciousness. How, since we're moving from inconscience to consciousness in various forms, initially, you know, he talks about this, he uses the term insentience, lack of sense, characterizes matter. So we can't even talk of suffering in the same way as we can talk about it for beings who have sense. So as we move from the inconscient phase of the evolution towards consciousness, these forms of consciousness that emerge are more insentient also than forms that are more evolved in a quote-unquote fashion. And that's the point he's making, that even if we think about animals or plants, and if we think about human beings, to some extent, you know, they're suffering in all these cases. But due to the reduced degree of sentience, it is as if the consciousness suffers less in these creatures. The nature of consciousness is less sentient. This is amazing because, in a sense, even as human beings are concerned, we find that, you know, even in the last 200 years or so, the sensibility of mankind has changed enormously. If we draw our minds back to even 200 years from now, I mean, life on Earth was full of perils for human beings, I mean, leave alone animals, for whom the peril is an ongoing one on a day-to-day basis. And it's a question of, you know, devouring or being devoured. At the human level, this problem of pain and suffering was enormously more. Life of the individual was subject to being attacked and in a subject to forces of suffering to a much greater extent. Today, by and large, we have policed our environment and have, whether we have curbed our own impulses of violence intrinsically or not, at least extrinsically, it has become much more painful to even think of it. See, the existence of suffering makes us shrink much more than with a certain kind of condition in which we expected it almost on a regular basis. So this, in a sense, greater refinement of this sentience, the ability to sense, brings with it an advantage and a disadvantage. It's an advantage certainly because our consciousness has become much more fine. We can experience much finer feelings. But it's a disadvantage because we can bear very little. So this is exactly where he's saying that it is the higher consciousness in us which must compensate for this lack that develops with the evolution. And the first way in which it can compensate is to subject the mental and vital and nervous being to a greater and greater equality, a power of peace that nothing can disturb. The greater the Purusha, presence of the Purusha, and its ability to be reflected to obedience of the instruments of Prakriti, the greater that infiltration of a peace that nothing can change. That establishing itself in the body can itself bring many new abilities of the body to be experienced. Now, here he's saying that that partial power is something that would be much more enhanced with the development of spiritual and Gnostic consciousness. Again, that's a yoga that has to be given its preparation. And if that preparation is established, it is further enhanced by the entry of a spiritual and Gnostic consciousness. He's saying that not only will it be able to impose a certain immunity to the shocks of the universe, but it will also bring power of delight into all our experiences. And this is where we were talking about that delight and conversion of all experiences to delight that is part of the siddhi of the body. Now, he's saying over here that if that establishes itself fully, if that unshakable delight, spiritual delight exists in the body, that itself is an active condition that can destroy every possibility of adverse experience. So the spiritual ananda can flow into the body and inundate cell and tissue. A luminous materialization of this higher ananda could of itself bring about a total transformation of the deficient or adverse sensibilities of physical nature. But this is one of the highest levels of achievement or of realization. This complete siddhi of delight in the body is one of the ultimate flowerings of this integral yoga. Prior to that, he's talking about a transition in which a higher consciousness can either turn the experiences of nature to delight or render them immune, be able to stop their vibration so that they don't translate into an experience of discomfort, pain, or something very adverse. That's a very interesting thought as well, where he's saying it can be associated to the self power of self-protection that turns away the shocks that are more difficult to transmute or to endure. So because this everything is progressive, nothing is achieved immediately. So while this power to transmute every experience into delight is being developed, at least there has to be a power to be able to quell the, you know, the ill effects of various forces. So this is the self-protection he's talking about, turns away the shocks that are more difficult transmuter to endure. The Gnostic evolution at a certain stage must bring about a completeness of this reversal and of this power of self-protection, which will fulfill the claim of the body for immunity and serenity of its being and for deliverance from suffering and build in it power for the total delight of existence. So this is a kind of an intermediate stage, just as we start with this ability to impose a greater and greater equality on mind, life, and body. That translates itself at the body level, at the level of physical consciousness, to a power to either stop or reject all vibrations that are experienced intuitively as being harmful. This is the self-protection that the body develops. And that becomes the basis for the condition of transformation of everything to delight.
So, the Vashishtha, can this be related to, you know, the Purusha becoming progressively the Sakshi, Anumanta and Ishvara over the Prakriti?
Yeah, undoubtedly, absolutely. And in fact, the kind of evolution he is talking about is of that nature, that it is the Prakriti that is becoming more and more fine and refined. Because, in fact, it is giving the right kind of instrument to a more powerful Purusha. But the Purusha is not kept step. Purusha in us is as asleep as the Purusha in the animal. Only it has awoken partially in Buddhi. But it has to awake finally much further and become these three things that you talked about. First Sakshi, then Anumanta, and then Ishvara. To each one of these is a certain degree of action of this, you know, all these various shaktis. If it is a sakshi, it can establish a certain degree of peace on the body, equality and peace on the body. If it is a anumanta, it can actually develop that power of self-protection by which it refuses the entry of certain types of forces into the body. If it is an ishvara, then it can actually become the will that brings the coursing of these higher powers of Shakti, of Ananda, and can transform, you know, the every experience into delight.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishtha. Shall we stop for today and continue next week?
Yeah, sure.
Let's end with a small meditation.